Hello and welcome to our webinar, Understanding Third-Party Cyber Risk in Singapore's Digital Ecosystem. I'm Charles Simon. I'm the Senior Global PR Manager at Security Scorecard, and I'll be hosting today's session. This webinar is based on our recent cybersecurity report, The State of Cybersecurity Resilience in Singapore, which we released in July. And today we're going to be discussing some of the findings of the report, the cybersecurity of Singapore, and third-party risk management in general. Our two experts today are Han and Gilad, who will be the brains of today's conversation. And I'll hand you over now to Han, who can introduce himself, his role, and his background in cybersecurity.
Hi, everyone. My name is Han, and I'm Senior Manager Solutions Architect covering APAC. I've been in cybersecurity consulting for over a decade, providing strategic technical advisory across various industry sectors and helping organizations strengthen their security posture.
Thank you. And Gilad, introduce yourself.
Thank you, Charlie. My name is Gilad Mythas. I am a security researcher within the strike team of Security Scorecard. I've spent the past 5 or so years researching APTs and their activities, state-sponsored APTs mostly, focusing on threat intelligence, activities, vulnerabilities, and malware.
Thank you both. Han, Singapore, from our report, ranks among the top globally for third-party breaches or breach rates. What factors do you believe are driving such high exposure?
Singapore is typically a regional hub for the APAC region and oftentimes a regional headquarters for companies in the region as well. So that means that it's usually a complex vendor ecosystem, especially in the critical sectors like finance, technology, and healthcare, which depends on numerous third parties and fourth party vendors as well. And that means as well an increasing point of entry for attackers. The other things that I can think of, it's a general push for digitalization across the region. There's also a rapid adoption of IoT and cloud services, as well as automation, which again leads to a larger attack surface and greater reliance on software supply chains. The other challenge here is while we have an increasing attack surface, most organizations do lack a direct visibility and oversight into their vendor ecosystem, especially the fourth-party risk, where almost, if not 100% of assessed companies reporting a breach of the fourth-party entities. The high-value sector in Singapore also attracts advanced threat actors, with just 10 groups responsible for nearly half the global incidents that we're seeing. And of course, the interconnectedness of Singapore makes it especially attractive.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Glad. How do you see the role of orb networks like the ones used in recent CyberNexus campaigns evolving in the Singaporean context?
Well, before we dive directly into orb activity, there's two main things that we need to consider. First of all, there is a rise in general reports on cybersecurity offensive activity, intrusion activity coming from CyberNexus APTs. Within the past month, we've seen a big rise in the past year, but within the past month, the amount of reports is increasing significantly. I think 300-400% from previous months. And the second thing to consider is that most APTs originating from China are moving, transitioning from using traditional attack surfaces to orbs. They share those infrastructures. These are going to be used more and more and more because they're effective. They're cheap, they're effective, and they're very easy to maintain over time. And usually, once they get a foothold in a certain device or manage to compromise a certain infrastructure, they're there for a while. And now we can dive into the orb and explain why that happens. Basically, an orb, an operational relay box infrastructure, is the kind of infrastructure where you would have control over multiple endpoints. These could be physical devices, these could be websites or infrastructure that is online, websites. But you would have control over them and you would use them as a mesh network, similar to how a VPN works, but you can also control each node within the endpoints of this network and utilize it for intrusive activity. For example, you can set up one of those edge devices that is compromised and turn it into a C2 server and use that as an APT. You can decide to leap into a company to use that as the window, as the vector, or use that against a different organization, a separate network, but just to obfuscate your own activity. So we're seeing that occurring all over the world, where you see operations to expand those orbs or create new ones spread like wildfire across mostly end-of-life devices. These could be new devices that can use zero-day vulnerabilities. We've seen that. And how would that affect Singapore? Well, most of these activities originate from China. And we know that many of China's activities have Singapore within their scope, historically, but also currently. We're tracking a few orb activities at the moment. Some of them don't seem to target Singapore mainly, but definitely have some nodes there, and that is a warning sign. Well, if you don't start treating it now, I would say this can expand, this can become a foothold. At that moment, once that happens, it really opens up multiple possibilities for the actor to operate in the future. Again, we're talking about devices that people usually don't patch. So they can stay there for years. They can use that for obfuscation. They can use that for reconnaissance. They could use that to collect NetFlow data and reconnaissance information, perform reconnaissance activities on organizations within Singapore without ever actively intruding on those, without actively leveraging vulnerabilities or dropping any malware. Just collecting that information can give them so much, especially when we're talking about the threat of breaking TLS encryption in the near future when it comes to supercomputing and quantum computing. So that is a threat that is looming over Singapore as much as it does on the rest of Southeast Asia at this point, and Europe and the United States to a larger extent. And I would say that keeping pace, paying attention, noticing how these activities are expanding and developing over time is a key factor if you want to defend yourself from those activities.
Thank you. Yeah, that's informative and also very worrying. But Han, I think kind of jumping off the back of that, I'll probably ask you a kind of double question here, which is given what Gilas has talked about, like what's the unique challenges that Singapore-based organizations are facing in securing their critical infrastructure, given the recent, you know, espionage campaigns? And sort of what are the common mistakes that Singapore-based companies are making when managing their cyber risk in the region?
One of the things that I think it's a unique challenge is, of course, having the increased focus by threat actors, especially a targeted espionage campaigns against Singapore, like the recent UNC 3886 attacks against our critical infrastructures. And some of them have exploited supply chain weaknesses with advanced stealth techniques. So the digital interconnected supply chains that Singapore has and the reliance on global technology providers also amplify the risk by increasing potential entry points for attackers. So OT systems, especially those that control critical infrastructure like energy, water, transport, and emergency services, are vulnerable. And attacks that are risking large-scale disruptions and cascading physical impacts, as well as physical safety incidents, are worrying. So when we see new connections, especially when you introduce newer technology into older systems, especially where OT is, that increases and expands the attack surface and sometimes bypasses controls that is there, right? Because you have to make two different systems work together. And when you introduce IoT, especially IIoT, industrial IoT, into the environment, that also expands the risk a little bit more. Challenges that we saw with UNC 3886 has been that adversaries can remain hidden for months on end, and post breach detection are usually still pretty much lagging behind the organization's visibility of those activities as well. So reporting and incident containment are evolving as we speak, and authorities are now mandating immediate reporting for suspected activities, right? So that's great because it helps the industry and helps the community learn quickly, and it triggers additional investigations when needed. So the common mistake that I think a lot of organizations make is that they treat cyber hygiene as a one-off exercise or as a compliance task. One of the common misunderstandings I've seen is treating compliance as a cybersecurity technique to protect organizations. Cyber hygiene or compliance is usually a barest minimum requirement that organizations should take. And oftentimes when we look at cybersecurity, we should take the highest and best practices. Cyber ratings and controls are often seen as an annual compliance requirement rather than the continuous monitoring and improvement tools. And that mindset has to change a little because compliance are typically a reactive approach, and that means organizations may miss ongoing threats and new vulnerabilities, especially evolving attacker techniques as well. So when you fail to have robust cyber standards and regular security assessments for your critical third and fourth parties, that leads usually to a systemic vulnerability for the organization. And that means that when you only monitor your direct vendors, you neglect the rest of the risk coming from the vendor's supplier. And this is what we call fourth party or nth party risk. And that's a major gap that can be exploited, as we have seen this year alone. We've seen multiple organizations being exploited through the vendor's suppliers, for example, with SalesLoft and Drift. So when we look at organizations not being able to fully map out that full extent of the supply chain, that results usually in a blind spot, especially for outsourced services, cloud platforms, and software dependencies. And when you have no visibility into these interconnected entities, your risk management is usually superficial and often incomplete. So what you need to do oftentimes is to have continuous visibility across all organizations and supply chain that you work with. So that's one big gap that I do see across organizations today.
Thank you, Han. That leads into another question I have, which is how can IT leaders better identify and assess hidden risks in their vendor ecosystem without talking too obviously about our company?
One of the things that we need to look at as well is first and foremost, starting today and not in a future planning session, right, where you start to map out all of your direct and indirect vendors, especially software dependencies, your cloud services, outsourced operations, and you identify every entity that has access to your data or your network, right? For example, integrated partners and so forth. Start extending your assessments, your risk assessments, not just your third party, but also your fourth or nth party vendors, by requiring supply chain disclosures and then cross-referencing against breach records, right? So knowing that a fourth party has had a breach recently is important, because that helps you to understand whether there's data exposure through your third party, just the fourth party. So at the same time, leverage tools that can help you automate this. And of course, a little plug to Security Scorecard here to kind of drive and monitor your vendor's supply chain posture in real time, and capture their changes, especially the external risk factors, quickly so that you can take proactive actions as well. So use tools like ratings that are based on transparent and evidence-driven criteria to help you with this assessment, and not just annual benchmarks as well, right? And of course, integrate all of this into your policies, your procurement policies, mandate disclosures of recent breaches and remediation strategies. And this would then help organizations be able to drive a stronger resilience across not just themselves, but their supply chain as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Gilad, I'm taking a slightly more international approach on this. Like, what can Singapore learn from recent third-party breach incidents globally in other sectors and in other countries?
The main aspect of these activities that we're noticing when it comes to victims affected by these attacks is the sense of disillusionment when it comes to the belief that they held before, that these whether they're relying on cloud infrastructure or third-party software services, that since they promise to implement better security measures than we have perhaps on-prem, companies have on-prem, then it's safer for the information to be there. And it's almost always a matter of implementation. If you implement the right security measures there, if you have the right visibility, if you collect logs, if you manage identity properly, then yes, information can be very secure in those platforms. But if you don't, then it doesn't matter how secure the platform is by itself. Your information is not secure there because it can easily be breached. Identity management, I think, is probably the worst offender. When you consider all the possible ways where threat actors would leverage or abuse these kind of services, the overwhelming majority of all attacks are targeting identities, where, look for the, user from 2 years ago that is for some reason still on and still has the right privileges, or that, software user, this API that you can somehow use without MFA because the API cannot do MFA by itself. And so you get these weak points where usually identity-based weak points where it becomes much easier for attackers to gain access to the information in the, and occasionally the entire platform for you. Do privilege escalation to the point where they can manage it for you. So I think the main thing to consider, and maybe that's emphasized also by the sheer differences that we see in the report itself between how safe Singaporean companies protect themselves and how vulnerable they are to third-party attacks. I think this, you know, disparity comes from perhaps the false assessment, perhaps, that cloud services or other third-party services are safer because they put more emphasis on security measures for their own platforms. But it doesn't mean that your information there is safer just because of that.
That's a very interesting point. Han, I suppose this takes me to another question I was going to ask related to this. So given kind of what Gilad just said, are organizations in Singapore doing enough to monitor their vendors and partners? And do you think regulation and compliance in Singapore are helping organizations to stay ahead of the supply chain threats?
Good question. One of the things that I mentioned earlier as well is I think organizations are very reliant, if not overly reliant, on periodic assessments rather than continuous real-time monitoring of the vendors and partner security risk. So when organizations focuses on the annual or scheduled compliance, you miss ongoing changes and emerging threats, especially from the vendor ecosystem, as we saw recently again with Salesforce, where companies are panicking, right, and trying to figure out who was affected along the way as well. So like Gilad mentioned as well, and where we covered in the report as well, 100% of the top 100 firms had strong ratings, but they still had exposure through their third and fourth party breaches last year, where this is a clear indicator that the static assessments fail to capture dynamic risk that we're seeing across the landscape. So threat actors know this, right? They know that organizations tend to follow a compliance model, and they try to exploit the time gap between assessments where they target supply chain vulnerabilities as they arise through the year. And of course, with the complexity of digital supply chains, especially in sectors with heavy outsourcing and global technology dependencies, there's a very high demand where risks need to be monitored in a continuous fashion as well. So organizations really need to shift from a point-in-time compliance to ongoing oversight, transparency, and accountability across the entire ecosystem. From a regulation and compliance standards perspective, we are starting to see that trend shift. The recent NIST Cybersecurity Framework 2.0 has indicated an increased emphasis on monitoring and looking at your third-party risk. We also see ISO 27001 evolving along the way as well. What I think it's needed as well is a stronger shift to indicate where organizations should move towards from a regulatory perspective. Because as you can see, from the scores alone, the regulatory environment has led to relatively strong internal security performance. Only 4% of the companies we're looking at were graded C or below, which is much higher than rates in Europe and other regions as well. So compliance typically drives the adoption of best practices, which is again for the self. But how do we apply compliance across to third and fourth parties, as we saw that 100% of the largest companies had breaches to that? It's important as well, right? So frameworks that rely on heavy periodic assessments and supplier certifications don't quite capture this emerging and new threats that we're seeing across the supply chain. So regulations need to shift a little to require organizations to adopt some level of real-time or continuous monitoring and having the requirements to demand greater transparency from the vendors and move beyond checklist-based compliance to a more continuous risk management and a resilience building for the organization. So this strong push for regulation needs to be complemented by this ongoing automated risk assessments and, if possible, enforce it with contracts so that it covers both your direct and indirect suppliers as well.
Gilad, preparation, prevention, and monitoring and understanding your supply chains. But how can companies build this resilience without slowing down their business operations or any innovation that they're doing? Is that possible?
Definitely possible. And without being clickbaity, I would say that I think the answer is within the question itself. You build it into the process. You implement security by design, and you don't consider, you don't put security as an afterthought. I think that that's usually what slows down business processes. You build everything, everything is ready, you know, your software is ready to be deployed for clients or whatever. And then you realize you have some kind of vulnerability and the whole process stops. And now you need to, you know, go through the entire code. You need to go through the entire process and understand where it got wrong. If you implement security by design, if you consider security as, you know, you give security considerations the same kind of importance as you would consider legal or financial ramifications for any decision you make, if you consider security to be on par with those, you know, factors, then the business process will go smoothly. Perhaps at the beginning, you will need to put a little bit more consideration, but once it's on track, you see that security is, your overall security will be stronger. Everything will be designed for that purpose. The same way that, you know, when you design a car, for example, you design it with the security measures in it as part of the design, and you don't put it as an afterthought. You know, you don't place the airbags somewhere in the car after you design the entire thing. You want to have security as part of the measures you take to design things. So that's my recommendation.
That makes sense. and I mean, when things do go wrong, you know, what are the most effective steps companies can take to recover quickly after a third-party related incident? Because we're seeing this a lot recently with Harrods, M&S, Jaguar Land Rover, Renault. There's been some huge breaches recently.
Yeah. I'm afraid there is no magic solution to how to manage those kind of incidents once they occur. I would say that the best steps are the one you take before. And it's kind of, I know it's kind of like cheating when I answer the question this way, but it is the best measures you can take to deal with those incidents are the ones you take before the incident. I can lay out three main things that I would consider to be the most important things. First of all, make sure you have a strategy. Make sure you have business continuity plan. Make sure you have the security, you know, a contingency plan. You have security measures in place for that rainy day, for that day where things go wrong. You're already a few steps ahead for most companies, most organizations, if you have that. The second thing is preparation. Make sure you have all the context required. Make sure your security vendors and retainers are prepared, that you know who they are, you know what? But you know who your DFIR team contact is before something happens, and you don't need to now start checking for teams when an incident occurs. Make sure your team, your internal team, is ready and prepared and aware. And the third thing would be make drills, you know, create exercises, not just awareness, but actual, you know, simulations of an incident. How do you react? Who do you call? Measure times. See how long does it take? See what kind of decisions are made when it's crucial. I think these three steps significantly improve the chances of an organization to recover from a major incident, if not to avoid it altogether. But it's nearly impossible to avoid it completely. Once it happens, you want your team to be ready to deploy. You want everything to be prepared for that day. And that's the way to do it, preparation.
Perfect. Thank you, Gilad. Very interesting. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to having you on another webinar in the future.
Thank you, Charlie.